The Place to Be podcast is a proud member of the History of WWE.com website. The History of WWE.com features thousands of complete cards and detailed results from throughout wrestling history for multiple major promotions, in addition to outstanding columns and reviews. It is also the official home of the Place to Be podcast and Scott and Justin's pay-per-view reviews. Visit us at thehistoryofwwe.com or on Facebook by searching for the History of WWE or the Place to Be podcast, because the History of WWE is always the place to be.
Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard? Come on, Rick.
What?
Come on. We call it the
place to be.
The place to be, yes.
It's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so.
That's what she said!
Why do I want this?
Yeah.
Because I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, it is now time for the Place to Be podcast. And now your hosts, Justin Rosero and Scott Criscolo.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great Place to Be podcast episode as the dulcet tones of ELO play us in this week. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, and joining me, as always, the man who has returned to Norwalk, Connecticut after a jaunt here to Rhode Island this past weekend. Digestive track, quite the mess, but still hanging tight with me, as always, is my PIC, Scott Criscolo. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, everyone. Welcome, Place to Be Nation. Of course, yes, I did return early this morning from Chateau de Cranstone. Yes, after a wonderful weekend of wrestling, bar food, and more wrestling, and football. Plenty of football. A lot of football yesterday. But I have returned, and I am down here, of course, in Norwalk CT. And welcome, everyone, to number 65. 65. Do you believe that? 65.
Oh, insane.
I mean, I'm counting. You and I were talking about it briefly this weekend. We might hit the C note by maybe Christmas? Maybe? Be ironic if number 100 was the last one of the calendar year. That'd be pretty funny.
Well, average of two a week would put us, you know, a little short of a year. So I'm guessing January. I know we've done a couple threes, but
right.
I'm guessing, yeah, it could be the last week. It could happen.
It could happen.
It'll
it
be
depends.
Around there. It'll be,
yeah, because there. I'm sure there might be a week or two where you and I may have to do three depending on topics. And we have, you know, preview shows, and because obviously we'll be talking college hoops soon and the like. But yeah, number 65, folks. And we thank our PTB Nation for being here from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, though. You and I talked about it last week when if you listen to, like, episode four, you're like, who the hell are these two idiots?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely and then all rough of a sudden, around the edges in those early ones.
Yes. But by the time, I would say, like, the late teens, I think we definitely hit our stride. So thank you, everyone, though, for joining us, as always. Number 65, Place to Be podcast. It is Monday night, and that, of course, means during the, as mentioned, for the next few months during the 2011 NFL season. Monday nights is V squared night, and the door's already open, and it is another exciting edition of course, the Vintage Vault here on the Place to Be podcast. And tonight we begin a new calendar year, and things we talked about winds of change on our last vault last week. Tonight we will be talking about a calm and a breeze blows. The breeze and the winds of change continue as we enter the new calendar year. But tonight, however, it is a calm before the storm.
Well as the World Wrestling Federation title itself.
And how about Big Boss Man taking on Bam Bam Bigelow? And what about that opening tag match with the Steiner Brothers?
What about the unveiling of Dark Surface?
Who cares?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Who cares?
As you can see, it's a sad ending, though. This is the first Royal Rumble without the Vince McMahon opening.
Yeah, this is where, again, we talked about it last week. The winds of change are blowing, and it's even blowing in the production department, as the awesome list of people does not get... Well, you know why? Because Vince really can't do the 30 men justice if he can't say, Haku!
True.
For the first time ever. So, of course, tonight on the Vintage Vault, we bring you the 1993 Royal Rumble. Winds of change. And tonight we see even more of it. And this is a where, and I want to preface another thing, another point. We've been, you and I have been pretty glowing of the reviews. Even shows that are not the greatest on earth, we still find silver linings. You know, you and I are, will always be eternal wrestling optimists. It takes a lot for us to find absolutely nothing redeeming about a show. It takes a lot for you and I to find nothing.
Right. Outside of the Hillbilly Brigade.
Well, yeah. And, you know, things like, you know, midgets playing basketball. No, that could save some paper.
A lot of redemption there.
Yes. But starting tonight, and for the next couple of years, pay-per-view years, of course, you and I are going to be a little rough. A little rough. Maybe not as much tonight, but most certainly next week. But tonight, no. Tonight, but just letting you know that you know, the happy-go-lucky WrestleMania 3, WrestleMania 6 days, for the moment anyway, are long behind us. Tonight, we're going to really have to start digging into finding redeeming qualities about some of these shows. Because, again, we talked about fleshing out of rosters and things, and tonight, again, you'll see a lot of different faces and different personalities that will kind of change things up. But, again... As we've always said, this may be a show that some people find one of the favorites of all time. It all depends on your point of view. We'll give you ours tonight.
All right, well, let's get into it.
January 24th, 1993, live from the Arco Arena in Sacramento, California, the state capital of California. And, of course, first jaunt out to Cali that doesn't involve L.A., in the pay-per-view lore. Of course, The Rock would forever immortalize this wonderful city 10 years later on a legendary episode of Raw. One of my favorites, lines of all time, and we'll play it. We're going to save it though. In case for those that may not know what I'm speaking of, we'll save it for when we get all the way down to, 2003, but one of my favorite moments of all time by Rock 10 years from now, in this exact city. But we turn back the clock again to the first pay-per-view of the calendar year, 1993. 16,000 at Arco. And as you can tell, the crowd sounded pretty hot. Buy rate 1.25. Not great, but not terrible. Your announcers, and for the last time, by themselves. You knew that, right?
Yes.
For the last time, by themselves.
Not even by themselves. Last time, all together. Together on a show.
That's right. Gorilla Monsoon. And Bobby the Brain Heenan. With every moment that you and I speak, the winds of change continue to blow.
Mm-hmm.
We have one dark match. Why don't you tell us what it is? Because it involves a guy who we were kind of hinting about on our last show, but doesn't make his official pay-per-view debut, but we might as well mention him.
Yeah, I guess it's time to talk about him. That is Doink the Clown. We first saw this mysterious clown at Survivor Series at our last review, mulling around the arena, taunting children.
Yes.
The Doink the Clown character, portrayed by Matt Bourne, who we last saw at WrestleMania 1.
Yep.
After that, he left WWF, headed to World Class Championship Wrestling, where he wrestled under his own name. Then he headed to WCW, where he was the legendary Big Josh, the Lumberjack character.
Yes.
Was there until late 1992, or mid-92.
Mm-hmm.
He then returned to the WWF in 1992 and began competing in dark matches as himself, actually.
That's right, yes.
Before taking on the Doink the Clown, villainous clown character. So we'll leave it there for now. He does wrestle here in his pay-per-view debut match, picking up a big win over Jim Powers at just under 6 minutes. But he'll enter his first big feud shortly after this show.
I forgot that Jim Powers was even still with the company. It's probably his first match in about 4 years. He might have been bouncing around.
Yeah, he was on TV.
He heads to WCW pretty much quickly after this. I think I remember seeing him in 93. It was early 94.
No, yeah, I think he's here until, yeah, probably 93, 94. I think he's there by the time Nitro kicks off.
Right. So there we go. Let's jump right into it. Our opener is a big debut.
He left in July 94.
Okay, so he's actually been here a while. All right. He becomes not a regular on Nitro, but he shows up a lot. 95 and through mid to late 96. All right, let's get down to the business. Our opener, and we actually mentioned, Gorilla mentioned the opener briefly. Another big debut here in our opener. No, it's not the Beverly Brothers. But the Beverly Brothers opponents are brand new. Not brand new to the business, but brand new to the World Wrestling Federation. And that is Scotty and Rick, the Steiner Brothers.
One of the greatest tag teams of all time.
Yes. Thought maybe you had the Michigan theme, but as a Notre Dame fan, I'm really glad you skipped it. Rick has actually been in the business a while. If you're a wrestling fan back in the day, Rick was around, 87. Rick, of course, was part of the import of Mid-South UWF guys. He was in Hot Stuff International, which was that faction with Eddie Gilbert, Missy Hyatt, Sting. Who the hell else was in that group? Rick Steiner is one other guy. And they were imported into Jim Crockett Promotions in 1987 when Watts liquidated the company. Well, they
and
did like
what's Watts' first name?
Cowboy. Well, I'll say Cowboy Bill.
Yes.
Right, what did I usually say?
You always call him Jim Watts.
Jim Watts, that's right. I was going to say Ted Watts. Cowboy Bill Watts. And his and no, we don't have any footage of Mid-South because his wife is holding it hostage in their divorce, so Vince might have to pull some of his feminine, his masculine wiles to get the Mid-South footage. And then he might probably have everything at that point. Anyway, Rick was a solo star for a couple years, really. He actually was in some good feuds in 87, 88. You and I are actually going over them now in our NWA reviews.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually feuding with Mike Rotundo.
Yes, very good.
Involving the television championship, managed by the Games Master, the man of 5 million nicknames, Kevin Sullivan. But Rick needed some help. He wanted some backup. Thus, he brings in his brother, Scott. And from that point on, for the next 3 years almost, the Steiner brothers, Rick and Scott, become one of the most successful tag teams in the world. Three WCW tag team championships. First in 1989. They beat the Freebirds, and then they bounce back and forth. Although kind of like the Rockers, it seemed like everyone thought that, well, or the Hart Foundation, it seemed like Rick was the anvil and Scott was the hitman. Everyone thought Scott had the future solo star potential.
Yeah.
So they always seemed to want to break this team up. But Scott, to his credit, at least for most of the next 10 years, decides, no, I am a tag team wrestler. Scott is my brother. Rick is my brother. Rick is my partner. That's it.
Right.
That's it. In fact, Scott did have a short reign as, in fact, I believe Scott had
Rick got hurt.
Yeah, Rick got hurt. So Scott's like, all right, I got nothing else to do. And Rick said, go ahead, I can't do anything. So he actually won the television title in late 92, but then vacated it when he and brother Rick bolted for New York, as they say in the promotion, in the territory biz.
Yes, your boy Jim Watts lowballed him on a contract. So Scott vacated his TV title, and they quickly signed up with Vince McMahon. He debuted an interview on the December 21st, 1992 primetime, and then their first Raw appearance was actually the first episode. Should we talk about Raw?
I was about to say, I think we definitely have to. Of course, by early 1993, again, things were changing. And after 8 glorious years, this is another symbol of the change in the end of the Federation era, as they call it, and the beginning of, I guess, what you could call, the mid-years or something. I don't know what the real official nickname would be of the next 4 years, but primetime wrestling would get a makeover. And on January 11th, 1993, live from the Manhattan Center in New York City, a place that Mean Gene Okerlund would affectionately call a toilet. we have the first ever episode of a brand new concept called Monday Night Raw.
And of course, this would be WWF's first live primetime show on a regular basis.
Yes.
On the USA Network, airing from 9 to 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. Each week would emanate for at least the first like 6 or 7 months. They'd be in the Manhattan Center each and every week. Vince McMahon, Randy Savage, and Rob Bartlett were the original hosts. Rob Bartlett was a comedian based out of New York. They brought him in to kind of mix things up a little bit.
He was actually a part of the I-Man, Imus's morning show.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he got a lot of his on-air shtick was with the I-Man on at the time. Let's see, was he on FAN in 93? I believe he was, yeah.
And they would be live most weeks early on and then eventually settle into they tape two or three at a time once they hit March and April. So,
right.
Rob Bartlett, they do a lot of topical commentary to try and kind of work his shtick in. And they had their moments. Overall, I found Bartlett pretty annoying because I actually just recently watched a lot of these Raws on Classics on Demand. He was pretty annoying to listen to. So,
most people that don't know what they're talking about are either really entertaining, a.k.a. your boy Ray Combs, or you just want to put a bullet in their head.
He seemed like he was trying to learn it, but I just didn't find his humor. But, I mean, then again, I'm watching it, 18 years later, so maybe it's just a lot of the humor's lost on me now. Maybe it was funnier in 1993, but...
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Well...
I didn't find it that overall that funny, so... Hmm. But that's it. So they would be the main commentary, and the show would feature, an array of squash matches with usually one or two feature matches between major stars. So
yes, and the very first match ever on Monday Night Raw would be
Yoko versus Coco.
There you go, Yoko Coco, and the first ever main event in the history of Monday Night Raw would be The Undertaker against a guy that we will see make his lone pay-per-view appearance later on in this show. And we'll tell you who that is later on. One of the more unusual characters of all time, and he ended up being a friggin' kook. But in any event, digress.
So a monumental showing here. And also a new TV show that debuted during this part of the year was WWF Mania, hosted by another New York radio personality, Todd Pettengill.
Yes.
And that was a Saturday morning studio show where it was just kind of highlights and clips over, Raw and Superstars and Challenge and featured some wacky antics from Todd. So Todd becomes, from here on out, with the departure of Sean Mooney in mid-93, becomes the main de facto backstage guy, event center kind of guy. So
for pretty much the next three and a half years almost. Yeah. Three and a half years. So, and this is where you started getting into your groove. See, this is where you and I kind of turn the corner in terms of watching. You really started getting into your groove as watching me. I was in college, so I kind of was doing other stuff. And I have to admit, when you and I first started watching stuff, and I started to actually, I needed to kind of, beef up my knowledge of the next 4 years through watching with you. So, and then of course we get into the Attitude Era and it switches again. But this is a good show to do because, again, we're talking about the start of really a brand new era, right? Pretty much from scratch. The primetime era days are over. The old look is over. And really, we're into a new, fresh outlook. The only issue is the roster, but we'll get to that as we move along. Anyway, let's get back to the opener. The Steiners are, of course, a brand new team, and they take on the Beverleys, who, did you feel at this point even they look dated?
Yeah, a little bit. I feel a little bit they were dated, so... it's sad. This is the end of the Beverleys.
Yeah.
From here on out, I think Bloom leaves, who was Bo, and Blake, Mike Enos, becomes a jobber through, I think, about July or August, and then he takes off. So,
right.
The genius, I don't even think he's even at the show either. So,
right. Well, we know that he's gone, right?
Yeah, the Beverleys are alone here, and they had a good run. Victims of circumstance, as we like to say, kind of screwed by other tag teams that showed up throughout 1992 or turned face and heel and got into the title mix. So they had a good run. And I like their feud throughout the summer of 92 with as they called the Legion of Sissies. But I agree. By this point, they probably weren't needed.
Right, exactly. And the Steiners win the match in a little over 10 minutes with a move that for a good while was actually very impressive looking for a guy as big as Scott Steiner was. And it will be called, obviously, the Frankensteiner.
Yeah, but it was already getting a little scary at this point when he was hitting it. Here, the way he hits it, it was very scary on Blake. It looks like he's going to break his neck. And then, as we'll see at our next show, it's even scarier. And you really wonder, you know, at this point, should he have even been doing it?
Yeah, they should come up with like a team, a tag move, you know, like a combo move at this point with two big dudes. It's not a bad match. It's okay. I mean, I was never a huge Steiners fan, but I felt that at the time, I think they did kind of fit into this new look WWF. So I thought it was fine.
Yeah, I thought they definitely fit in. They were hard hitting, Smash Mouth is certain commentators like to say, and they were hard hitting, good brother team. They had a good fluid offense already. They didn't have to like gel. You know, they came in as a united set tag team. That had a look and a well-known story. So they were easy to latch onto at this point. You could tell already at this point that they were kind of head and shoulders above the rest of the tag division, including the champions.
Exactly. And so the Steiners win their opening match in WWF history with a win over the Beverly Brothers in just under 11 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And
good opener. And I will say this about the Sacramento crowd. We'll see this throughout 93. Very hot crowd.
Yes. Yes. I concur. When we get into crowds, we'll talk more about the next week's crowd, which is very analytical to think about, but very different. But the rest of the, I agree. The year, we had some good cities. 93 was a good year for cities because those cities' crowds are always very loud and loyal. So,
yep, this one's very good.
And Sacramento, it makes its debut. They want to get hot, and they like the Steiners. So, good opener. Steiner Brothers win over the Beverlys with the infamous Frankensteiner and Mike Enos, who, of course, another history. He's in a historical television match, 3.5 years down the line.
Yes.
We'll get to that, of course, when we get there. But a lot of history here. A lot of history in this show.
All right.
From various sides. So the Beverly Brothers win. I mean, the Steiner Brothers win. Beverlys take the hit, and then they ride off into the sunset as a team.
All right.
Why don't you let us know about our next match, which is our first Taste of Gold this evening.
Yep, second match is a highly anticipated match, one a lot of fans have been waiting for a long time. That is Shawn Michaels defending his Intercontinental title against Marty Jannetty, former Rocker tag team partner. Of course, we talked about this at our last show. Jannetty returned on October 31st. Superstars jumped out of the crowd, grabbed Shawn Michaels' mirror, was about to hit Michaels with it, but he pulled Sherry in front of him, smashed Sherry, and she was off TV until this show. There was tease that she would be at the Rumble. She came out before the match, and they teased that she would be going, you know, she would make her choice of who she was going to be with, either Shawn or Marty going forward. Would she reunite with her boy toy, or would she see the footage of Shawn pulling her in the line of fire and Marty inadvertently hitting her with the mirror? So that was the question heading in here.
Yeah.
I remember at the time, I was definitely really pumped up for this match. Shawn and Marty, always the tag team specialist, but it was always one of those teams that you figured as soon as they get together, they're going to have an awesome match together. And they don't really quite deliver that just yet here. As we see later in the year, they will pull one out, but for now, they don't quite get it done. I think the storyline overtook the quality of the match. I think that was the main issue here. You know, a lot of posturing with Sherry at ringside, and you could tell maybe they were a little uneasy wrestling each other at this point.
Yeah, you know, Marty had been kind of out of the loop for a little while. Shawn, meanwhile, really was starting to get his groove down and get his in-ring flow going. And, you know, Marty just really wasn't quite there yet. You know, he really hadn't wrestled much since the end of 91, so he pretty much almost had all of 1992 off. And, you know, just doesn't look right here. And I don't blame him for that. I mean, he hasn't been on camera and he hasn't been really doing matches.
Well, you wanted to. I mean, there are rumors that he was not in the right state of mind for this match. And I think it kind of shows maybe a little bit. And the fact that he's actually released right after this match probably speaks to the fact that something was going on with him. So,
yeah.
And then he will be back later in the year. But he had just made this big return. This feud is just kicking up. You figure they're going to probably fight at WrestleMania, you would assume. The rematch, and maybe Jannetty wins the title there.
Yeah, exactly.
But he's quickly released. So, kind of surprising. And actually, here, I'm going to read this. It was planned for the two to continue the feud, but Jannetty was released again after rumors circulated stating that he had been under the influence of alcohol or drugs during the match, leading to its low quality. Jannetty, to this day, denies being intoxicated at the event, but explains having been rather tired because of lack of sleep, and the rumor that he had been started by Shawn Michaels, who was supposedly not in the best condition himself at the Royal Rumble. So he blamed Shawn for that, and said that he was not intoxicated. But either way, he was released right after.
Yep.
So that's it for Marty's quick run here. But the match itself, I mean, for an IC title match on a pay-per-view like this, it's decent. It's good, actually. But for these two guys, you definitely expect more.
Yeah, I was disappointed when I didn't watch the show live. I think I rented it like a couple weeks later. I was disappointed. I was expecting a lot more drama, a lot more intrigue, and it just seemed like another match. Actually, and to be honest with you, Sherry's presence takes away from the real crux of the match, which was Sean turning on Marty and destroying the Rockers and everything.
Yeah.
It seemed like that was totally clouded with Sherry. And it takes away from the drama of the fact that these two guys were an amazing tag team for, you know, almost 4 years and ended up just, you know, Sean just said, "Ah, screw this, I'm going to be on my own." And that never really came into play. It was all
I think it was the fact that they were in a tough spot because Marty was gone for so long that a little bit of that heat was kind of gone by that point. But it kind of had to be that way for Sean to really grow into this character before being a hot enough heel to carry this feud. So it was kind of a catch-22.
Exactly.
But Marty came back, and they did their best to play up the history here. But like you said, the Sherry part kind of overrode what could have just been a hot feud on its own.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a bummer. It's a bummer. But Sean does retain his championship and begins what ends up being a kind of an odd 1993 calendar year for him.
Mm. Well, all right, let's hear how he retains here. Of course, throughout the match, Sherry was kind of playing it down the middle, and then at one point she smacks Michaels and shows that she's turning on him. She knows that he is the one that caused her to get hit by the mirror, and then he didn't call her anything. The hospital's revealed later. So during the match, the referee gets bumped, and that's where we pick it up.
Got an elbow from somebody. It was Shawn Michaels inadvertently. And look at this now.
So I remember that being a pretty big upset in my eyes at the time as a kid, actually. Even though Sean was kind of the dominant IC champion, I really thought Marty was going to win. I thought it was a no-brainer.
Right.
So I remember being shocked that Sean just kind of pinned him so nonchalantly, and then they would fight to the back. So it might be the first – well, it's actually, you know, obviously the first pay-per-view win that Michaels picks up with the eventually to be named Sweet Chin Music.
Yes, and I believe that is where his music that he uses, his theme that he's used today – debuted.
Sherry's still
singing that one?
Yep. At our next show, he has the current version.
Okay, it's not. All right, so I'm off by one show. Okay. So this is the last one where he uses the song that Sherry sings. And starting with our next show, he uses the one he would end up using for the next 18 years. So, minus a few. So Sean retains his championship with a win over Marty Jannetty in what ended up being a kind of an underwhelming match under the circumstances. Our next match actually is a dream match for my PIC.
Yes. Sad beginning, a happy beginning, but a sad end.
That is right. Yes, everyone. He has finally returned after almost 4 year hiatus. SCB from the streets of Asbury, just north of London, Delaware, or Delaware, England, whatever it was. Bam Bam Bigelow, BBB, is back in the WWF. And his opponent, a guy who has almost similar build, but unfortunately is leaving us. And that is the Big Boss Man. And it's funny, you make a good point in your fun fact. These two intersect often throughout the history of wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
When Bigelow was getting shunted out the door by the Orange Goblin in the summer of 88, the Big Boss Man was taking off his Big Bubba Rogers suit put on the prison guard outfit. I forgot. I blanked on Cobb County, Georgia. The Cobb County prison guard outfit, and became the Big Boss Man, and would have a very eventful 4.5-year career in the WWE. But now, again, another case of things changing. One of the stalwarts, one of the foundations of the Federation years, makes his final match for almost 5 years here in Sacramento, and he takes on Big B Cubed. You must have been thrilled to see Bigelow back.
Oh, yeah. I was very excited. Well, honestly, I mean, I had only seen him at this point through videotape, so...
Oh, that's true, yeah.
I didn't really see him live, but I attached to him right away. He comes in here as a heel. Of course, as his last run, he was a face back in 87 and 88. Comes in as a heel. In his time off, he spent a lot of time in Japan after a quick run in the NWA in late 88. A very good run in Japan. He would win the IWGP tag titles with Vader, becoming an awesome heel monster team. In the late 92, he returned to the WWF as a heel, where he'd have probably his, I guess he'd have a better run a little bit later on, another promotion, but this is definitely the better of his two WWF runs.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Big Boss Man, on the other hand, is finally kind of run his course. He had a feud with the Mountie, then they finally did the, ex-convict angle that you figured they'd do at some point, so they got that out of the way in 92. And now he's on his way out the door, and he would head to WCW. Later in the year, but he will be back later on in the 1990s. But for now, we bid farewell to the Big Boss Man. And we'll get to the reason why he's gone at our next show, because it helps explain the build of another feud. So
yes, and we won't give you a record, because he does return.
Yes.
So we'll give you the record when he comes back, when he ends his second run in a few years. The match is...
Yeah, little. I mean, what you'd expect.
Yeah, I mean, two big dudes, very slow, kind of plodding along, and Bigelow gets the win with his big finishing move, the flying headbutt.
Yeah, I thought he hit the headbutt pretty stiff.
Yeah.
9 minutes. I like the match just because of who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. When you look at it objectively, though, I can say, yeah, it was a little boring. I can't defend it too much, but
yeah, no,
I just like the dichotomy. I like these two guys, two stalwarts, two hosses going at it, stiffing the crap out of each other. So it actually probably could have been a pretty good feud if Boss Man wasn't kind of on his way out and just putting Bigelow over all the way out the door.
Right, exactly. That's the unfortunate part. But, it is a good start for Bigelow, and he has a very start of a very entertaining almost 2 years. Here in WWE.
It's kind of weird, too, seeing Boss Man just in a pay-per-view match. When's the last time he's been in a pay-per-view match with no feud behind it? And when's the last time he does jobs like this, cleanly?
Well, jobs cleanly, probably never.
Right? I don't think he ever really jobs on pay-per-view.
And in terms of just bland matches, probably the first one. Who do you fight?
Yeah, Coco.
Tara?
No, Coco.
No, it was Coco in SummerSlam 88. Yeah, after that, he jumped right in. He was, pretty much within a couple months, he was right there with Akeem. The Twin Towers were started. Feuding with the Mega Powers, so it was pretty much right off the bat.
Is this the first, maybe one of our PTB Nation members can confirm this for us when they listen, but this might be Boss Man's first pay-per-view pinfall loss.
Well, we'll have to investigate that, but let me think. It's not 1996.
I think it is.
Singles match, yeah. How about that, huh?
Even Survivor match, I think. Oh, I guess, yeah, Survivor Series 89 he was pinned.
Oh, right.
And Survivor's 92? Probably 90 as well. So, okay. Well, yeah, first singles pay-per-view pin.
Yeah,
he
Survivor
lost
Series
a couple
pins.
Survivor matches.
Yeah, Survivor Series pins don't really count. Everybody gets pinned in those matches at some point, except Hogan. And Warrior, I guess. Good night, Boss Man. I'm going to miss you, man. You were a favorite, a stalwart. That's a good word, Justin.
A lot of good matches over the last few years. A lot of memorable feuds. Definitely one of the memorable... fan favorites from that era of when we were all growing up. One of the guys you always think of, Big Boss Man.
Yes. But he will be back. He will be back somewhere down the line. Bigelow, however, is just getting started. So he wins his first pay-per-view match, singles match in WWE ever, and the Boss Man goes gentle into that good night. And Justin will mention the backstory on it on our next vault next week because it involves other people. So... we now go to, and my PIC will introduce our second and final championship match of the evening.
Yes, and that is Bret Hart defending his World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Championship title against Razor Ramon, the man we last saw at Survivor Series teaming with Ric Flair. After his feud with Macho Man kind of petered out in the house show circuit, he was named number one contender. And he wanted to add a little bit of heat to this match. So he's trying to think of a way to get under Bret Hart's skin.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened on the very first episode of the aforementioned WWF Mania.
Obviously, your father was a big influence on you and on Bret.
Hey, Ross. Did Daddy teach you that one, right?
Oh. All
right.
Well, that was the Rocket Owen Hart, who literally got creamed, and he is the brother, the little brother, I might add, of WWE Champion.
So there you have it. Razor Ramon jumped Owen Hart during it while he's being interviewed by Ray Rougeau, and add a little bit of heat to this because there wasn't really much of a feud here, just a world title shot for a big heel guy getting a push. Yeah. I always liked this match quite a bit. I love the old school feel to it. And I've talked before on the show, I think as recently as our last show, how much I love just pay-per-view title defenses or TV title defenses with the champion getting a hard-fought win over a top contender. And this is that. Razor Ramon goes move for move with Bret. Bret dictates a great match. 18 minutes long. They really put on some good power offense by Ramon. Bret does his usual selling, and then he fights back and gets the win. Hard-fought win, and just a well-structured, smart match that I always really, really got into.
I concur. I liked, you know, you look at these two guys and you think they're not going to mesh together. You know, Bret is his typical technician, and Razor is this big, you know, lumbering, you know, power guy. And instead, for the first of two times this year, these two get in the ring together and put on a pretty sensational match. We both graded it fairly well. I'm curious to see what our PTB Nation thinks when we get to our feedback a little bit later. Curious to see their comments on this match, because this is one match that, you know, a lot of people, kind of in the same vein, even though it may not have as much of a historical perspective, but almost the same vein as we mentioned a few weeks ago when we were talking about Roddy Piper and Bret at WrestleMania 8, a match that I think a lot of people really like, but when you think about great matches off the top of your head, this one doesn't come to mind. You got to think about it for a little bit, and then when you do, you're like, wait a minute, this actually was a good match.
Yes.
Believe it or not, it is not on any DVDs. In fact,
I must just preface it.
I agree. I thought it was on Bret's, but it's not. I want to preface by saying, as I always do when I investigate our wonderful friend, the Broham, Graham Cawthon, the history of WWE.com. Other than the digipack on the Royal Rumble anthology, none of these matches are on any other DVDs, which kind of makes sense, I guess.
Might be rare. A rare pay-per-view that didn't have anything anywhere. So
yeah.
And a pretty and a decent show. It's not, you know, a garbage show. So
no, but... I think that Razor really came into this match wanting to impress.
Yes, I agree with that. And he does.
I think so too. Bret really came in to his own the tail end of 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I want to really get this thought out. Here, I think we really see the respect that the company gives him. Because this isn't facing a guy like Sean, a small guy, or a guy like Bulldog. This is a guy that really you would think Bret has no chemistry with whatsoever. It's just this big dude,
and fairly green, and fairly green in this role. I mean, he had a good run in AWA, but he was a face. He hasn't really had that heel powerhouse domination role yet.
No. And Bret really comes out and delivers a grade A match. And he doesn't deserve all the credit. Razor really... Bret helped him dictate his power portion of the match.
Yeah, he just really uses that methodical power offense, just pummels Bret for the majority of the match, and the crowd really gets behind Bret, rallying him back, and it's just a really, hate to say beautiful, but a really good, old-school, solid title defense. And Brett eventually gets the sharpshooter, putting over his finisher. Razor taps. I thought Razor actually maybe had a shot to win this match. I guess I didn't realize at the time, at that age, that Brett was going to become what he became. You know, I thought he was a good champion, but I didn't think he was really going to become the standard bearer of the promotion. It seemed more like maybe a transitional guy at the time. So I would have shocked me at the time if Razor actually took the belt home. So
I think this was an opportunity for Razor to showcase what would become the next, what, counting both companies, 6 years of his career.
Mm-hmm.
He should be very, who knows what he's thinking at this point in his life, but he really should be happy with how his career progressed from this match forward. So a lot of kudos to Brett for helping this guy out. You know, maybe they had their issues once Brett went to WCW later on and all that other nonsense, but this is really a very good example of the kind of ring general that Bret Hart is at the time and would eventually become. And when we get to 1994, 1995, when the KLIQ starts, you really have to give Brett a lot of credit, because the only other guy that could make any of those other guys look good other than each other was him, if you really think about it. But we'll get to that down the line. This was a great match. Definitely the match of the night, and probably where a majority of our grade leans on.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
So a good match, too, and not a cheap match. Just barely, just a skoosh under 18 minutes, so nothing cheap.
No.
Not a throwaway whatsoever.
No, funny, if you haven't watched this match in a while, check it out. It's a lot of, it's just, I mean, if you're a fan of old school style, you know, face starts off strong, heel dominates, face gets the win. I know it's pretty much every wrestling match, but in an old school way,
right,
just rallying the crowd, building the heat, and really telling just an old school psychological story. Check this one out. It's really a fun title match.
I am honestly surprised that this match is not on a DVD. I thought Brett would put it on his, but I guess not. Maybe he didn't like it as much, but interesting. Okay. We have one more. Well, we mentioned this guy a few pay-per-views ago, but now he really gets things into high gear in terms of his character and makes his big splash here. Why don't you let the nation know?
All right. With the demise of the WBF, the World Bodybuilding Federation, Lex Luger was now a man without a home, so they decided it was time to bring him in as a wrestler. In the weeks leading up to the show, Bobby Heenan began talking about a man he was going to unveil at the Royal Rumble, the Narcissus. And he said this man was a beautiful human being, as the Narcissus tale goes, a guy who was muscular and pretty and everything else, obsessed with himself. So it was fairly obvious who it was going to be, because there's only one man in wrestling that probably really fit that bill at the time.
That's true.
And that is, of course, Lex Luger. So as the Rumble hit this point of the show, Bobby Heenan goes over to the podium. There's a big cape around, not cape, what am I looking for? The word.
What?
I want to say robe. Curtain. A giant curtain.
Curtain, yeah, curtain.
Hanging down, and they raise the curtain, and there's Lex Luger with a giant mirror. And after posing for what seemed like 25 minutes, to 40 minutes maybe, Lex Luger decided to talk a bit.
Three in the making. I will be, mark my words, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most dominant force that the WWE has ever seen. All of the wrestlers will bow down on their knees before me, because I am the most metamorphically magnificent physical specimen beyond perfection. And speaking, Bobby, of perfection, I know you're impressed.
Uh-huh.
I know everybody out here is impressed with me, Lex Luger. But I know somebody else who's back there watching, who I know is impressed. But the most impressive thing of all is when I step in the ring. And Mr. Perfect, that's when you will find how truly great the Narcissist Lex Luger is. If, that's if, you've got the guts to take the challenge.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been part of history. Forget the inauguration. Forget the Elvis Presley stamp. is what it's all about. This is the highlight of my career. It's an honor. It's a pleasure to have been able to stand here and unveil you to the millions of people. And now the curtain comes down. Let's see some more. Just a little more. Look at the back. Look at the size of this man. Look at the legs. Please, let's see some more legs. One more shot of the legs.
Talk about a time warp, the Elvis Presley stamp.
And
Bobby, a little creepy in this little promo here as he espouses over each and every muscle on Lex Luger's body as the curtain comes down upon them to close out the segment.
Not the same as September 9th, 1991, when he was making the introducing the wonderful debut of the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. This one is a little, I don't know, it seems a little more hollow. And in fact, weren't they? Didn't Bobby earlier in the show call him Narcissus?
Mm-hmm.
Like that was going to be his name? Was that rumored?
I don't know if it was rumored, but that was what he was referred to for a long time before the show.
Narcissus.
Yeah. And then it became the Narcissist.
Yes. And then finally, Narcissist. They figured out how to say the friggin' word. I loved actually this character. Why? Because again,
fit him perfectly.
I felt it because it was him.
Yeah. Yep.
Just look, Lex. Put these tights on and just act like a selfish asshole. Oh, wait a minute. You do that all the time anyway. So just go out there and be yourself. And I really think that could have stayed in that character, but obviously takes a turn for the worse, but we'll get to that later.
And as we mentioned before now, Luger, of course, was in a motorcycle accident over the summer while he was with the WBF. And they actually used that as part of the storyline because once he starts wrestling on TV, he would knock guys out with a forearm.
Yep.
And that was his finisher, and they would reveal that he had a steel plate in his forearm from the accident, so that would become a big part of controversy as 1993 rolls along.
Yes. Yes. I was actually kind of excited, as much as I disliked Luger a lot when he was in the NWA and WCW, I kind of dug him here.
Yeah, it was perfect for him, and I mean, he had a little bit of a lethargic finish to WCW, but we hadn't really seen the classic, you know, lazy choking Luger to this any kind of extent, yeah, at this point.
Right, exactly. So we are now up to our last match, but we're going to take a breather because, you know, you need to, Narcissist wants some more time to on the stage. So while he's doing that, before we get to our last match, why don't we take a break and talk about our wonderful friends at WrestleChat.net because
promotional considerations paid for by the following.
Pro wrestling news websites do you visit to get your daily news? 3, 4, maybe 5? Do yourself a favor and make that number 1. WrestleChat.net, the only professional wrestling news site that brings you all wrestling news all day long, and is home of the critically acclaimed Still Real to Us podcast, starring former CZW, ROH, and ECW announcer Eric Gargiulo and the champ Jeff Peck. That's WrestleChat.net. WrestleChat, it's where it's at.
And of course, our weekly news and notes segment, not tonight, of course, on our podcast later in the week, brought to you by your good friends at WrestleChat.net. And also, you can go right to the right side of the front page and click on the Place to Be podcast link and go right there. So, go to WrestleChat.net, your only source for wrestling news.
You know, my name is Ox Baker, and I like to beat people up, and this is the place that I want to be.
All right, as Ox Baker welcomes us back from break, we have returned to the Vintage Vault, talking about the 1993 Royal Rumble. Now, before Scott fires up the actual Rumble match itself, we have another little interlude segment, and this time, an actor, or maybe it was the real guy, Julius Caesar, comes out.
Look good.
Looked like Michael Buffer.
He did, actually. He did have a nice coiffed hairdo and some other girl, I guess. What was that supposed to be? Athena or Cleopatra. That's
right. Cleopatra. So they make their way out and they give the official proclamation that the winner of this match, the Royal Rumble match, will receive the World Heavyweight title shot at WrestleMania 9, which was occurring in Caesar's Palace. So that is why Caesar and Cleopatra are involved here. And of course, this is the first official Rumble that the title shot is on the line for.
Yes, and from here on, for the rest of eternity, this is what the Royal Rumble is all about. It is one shot to be on the big stage at WrestleMania.
Now, do you think they needed this shot in the arm here?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just having this match like we had the first four, 88, 89, 90, 91, wasn't going to fly anymore. We are now at the stage where this was a time, I think, where WCW was starting to kind of give a little nudge to Vince that their pay-per-views were actually getting a little juicy.
Yes.
And now, particularly the first, the show before, at least for the next, 3 years, the show leading into WrestleMania needed to have some juice. So I don't think there's any doubt that this needed to be done.
Well, it was right there staring them in the face, honestly.
Yeah, it was.
I mean, it made perfect sense. It was, you know, 3 months before Mania. The match, the Royal Rumble match at this point was kind of like, all right, what are these guys fighting for? It's a fun match, but it's starting to lose a little bit of its luster.
Right.
So I think this is a very, very smart move.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I will fire off our 30 participants, and then my PIC will give us any goodbyes or hellos as we go down the list. Yeah, there are quite a few in this match. And why? Look who comes out at number one. For the last time, you know, I know we had our issues at SummerSlam, and you know, there were some things going on at Survivor Series, but this is officially the end of the line. I'll be all right. Give me a minute. The defending Royal Rumble champion. 1 year ago, 3,000 miles away in Albany, New York, this man won the World Wrestling Federation Championship in this exact match. And now 1 year later, he is at number one.
And yeah, what a difference a year makes.
I concur. Bobby doesn't really get into, I mean, a year ago, you'd think Bobby was married to him. This time around, it's just, oh, there's Flair.
You know? Well, I mean, he plays it up a little bit when he comes out number one. I mean, he definitely gets fired up and he's yelling a little bit. But you could tell it didn't have the same juice behind it.
No, it didn't. It didn't. So, at number one, in his final WWE pay-per-view appearance... Watch it and see. If you give a little more than you're asking for, your love will turn the key. I just want to be your everything. Open up the heaven in your heart and let me be the things you are to me, and not some puppet on a string. I will be no puppet on a string.
Sad day. It's a sad day.
It is a sad day. Now, just to give you a little background on why he's leaving, and we might as well mention it now.
Yeah.
The following night, was it? I think it was the following night.
Yeah, it was the next night. Yeah, because they flipped it throughout the show.
Yeah, the next night on Raw, finally, the long-awaited one-on-one match between the Nature Boy Ric Flair and his former running buddy, Mr. Perfect, they would finally have their match the next night on Raw. But there is a stipulation involved. The loser leaves the World Wrestling Federation. Out the door. And sure enough, it actually was a pretty good match, if I remember. I think I remember liking this match. It's on the Raw set.
Yes.
It's on a few things, right?
Yeah, it's
on the
very
Raw
good
set.
Yep.
Is it on Perfect's DVD?
Go ahead. Just a little background music as you eulogize.
Let me just check Perfect's DVD and see if that matches on here. Let's see. Matches. No, it's not on his DVD. So, When Ric Flair arrived in the WWF in late 1991, he was told by Vince that I want you here to be a main player, you to be a top flight guy. And Vince Flair had an unwritten dream that if Flair was going to be shunted down the card to mid-card status, wanted to come and he was going to be pushed down the card a little bit. So Flair said, I'd like to leave the other pastures, and Vince said, well, you and I had an agreement, good luck, maybe I'll see you again someday. And with that, Ric Flair went back to WCW. He would I think, I don't know if he was injured or was kind of a no-compete, but he would go back to WCW. He would host a segment called Flair for the Gold, which was an interview segment, which would have its kind of memorable moments in it, including the debut of the Awesome Shockmaster. But then he would get back in the ring later in the year, and at Starrcade, at the end of the year, he would defeat Vader and once again become WCW World Champion.
Okay, we'll leave the eulogy there. I don't think we need to talk about this whole WCW.
No, let's go with the rest. When he makes his return, far down the line, we'll continue on. But anyway, after a marvelous, 15 months, the player is gone.
All right, Scott wipes his tears. We move on.
I'm okay. I can move on. Sorry.
The question, Scott, is,
yes,
how much money did you loan Ric Flair in his time of need?
Yeah, well, we're not going to talk about that right now. Listen, okay. He said he would pay me back. It's all right. As long as he gives me the NWA title. I think he promised that to some other loan shark, Johnny the Nose or something.
He's getting other people.
Anyway, speaking of a departure, at number two, we have a return. Actually, it's not a return. Technically, it's a debut. A return to the company, but a debut on pay-per-view.
Yes.
And at number two is former World Wrestling Federation champion Bob Backlund.
Unreal that this guy came back. Who would have ever thought? Of course,
I know.
He was the long-term WWF champion back, yes, in the day under Vince McMahon Sr. He was brought in early 1977, managed by the Golden Boy Arnold Scotland, received his title shot against superstar Billy Graham on February 20th, 1978. He pinned Graham, won the world title, and would hold it for 6 years. Epic run.
Amazing. Speaking of, I got a Arnie Skolin, by the way, just to let you know, was on the same dodgeball team with me and Toots Mott.
Okay.
Just to let you know. Arnie's a good friend.
I'm still not sure that you and Toots Mott weren't the same person.
Let me tell you something. If I wanted to be any part of a group, it would definitely be the Goldust Trio, let me tell you right now. Me and the Toots.
All right. So Backlund had a great run of MSG house show matches, of course, some good feuds. Greg Valentine, Big John Studd, Antonio Inoki,
Stan Hansen.
Yes. A lot of great
Snuka.
Yep.
Yes.
Matches with Hulk Hogan before he was a face in his original heel run.
Yep.
He eventually lost the title, of course, in that controversial match, December 26, 1983, mm-hmm, where he lost to the Iron Sheik. He was locked in the camel clutch. Arnold Scotland threw the towel in. He never gave up. And he returns here. He left in 1984. August 4th was his final match for 8 years. He had a short run in the Pro Wrestling USA promotion, a little NWA, AWA action there. Then he kind of disappeared. And then he returns here, shockingly, a guy that we never thought we'd come see back, because he was one that always ran his mouth saying he didn't like the direction of wrestling, where it was going, how it was being treated. He liked, yep, it better when it was a professional sport.
Yep.
But, you know, I guess money talks, or he was getting the itch. So in late 92, he comes back. He's really portrayed as this gritty veteran trying to get it done on one last run. And that's really how he's portrayed throughout this run, is just this, can this old guy come back and do anything?
Right.
And they built him up as a major underdog. But they also, at the same time, really acknowledged his history and put him over as a major star. And he did reference the fact that he felt he was never pinned, and he never lost the WWF title, and basically saw himself as still the world champion. So he was kind of a weird presence in this newfound, fan-friendly, gimmicky WWF that we're in now. While it's not as gimmicky as it used to be, and not as gimmicky as it would get, but still a little gimmicky compared to when he was last here. So now, also now you have this old-school shooter guy in the mix. So makes his first, obviously, his first pay-per-view and first Royal Rumble appearance. He enters number two in a pretty cool matchup with him and Ric Flair, I must say.
Yes. The two of them faced each other numerous times between 1981 and 1983 when Flair was the NWA champion and Backlund was, of course, the WWF champion. Usually those matches ended in, you know, double DQs or double countouts or crap like that. Obviously, no one was going to win two titles. Backlund had more. Actually, he had some better matches with Harley Race. They would end up having, and I'm not sure if this is on a tape or a DVD, but they wrestled to like a 90-minute draw at the Orange Bowl in like, I don't know, February of 80 or something. But apparently, it's an amazing match, and it's got some crazy grappling and chain stuff and... It's supposed to be well, I don't know where the hell we can find it, but apparently it's an exceptional match. And what's funny as well, JR, is that in Backlund's first run, kids were never really part of the equation when it came to crowds.
No.
If you look at the crowds in, if you look at the crowds in, you know, 78, 79, 80, 81, it was all, you know, guys that looked like your dad and my dad and, you know, old Italian guys, you know, with us. They all look like Lou Albano.
Right. I mean, especially in MSG.
Yeah.
Heavy Italian population at that, you know, in New York and everything, and big and still from the Bruno era and everything. But yeah, right. It was an older crowd because it was seen as more of a legitimate sport at that time.
Yes. And I actually do want to apologize because our dads are not big, fat, sloppy pigs.
No.
But my point is all, you know, big, you know, looking Guidos and you know, the melting pot of nationalities at Madison Square Garden back in the day. But in terms of kids, no, the kids didn't kick in until the rock and wrestling era started, which was obviously after Bob Backlund left. So this is kind of new to him. He is kind of like in a foreign land here with all these kids wearing, you know, you see Bob Backlund t-shirts or anything like that. It would have been kind of cool. I bet you would have bought one if there was a Bob Backlund t-shirt.
Of course.
At number three is Papa Shango, whose last pay-per-view appearance was almost botching the end of the main event of WrestleMania 8. Haven't seen him on TV since. Not TV, haven't seen him on pay-per-view since.
And we don't see him again.
Nope. Gone after this? Well,
yeah. His character. Yeah, he'll be back in mid to late 94 as a new second character.
Yes.
So, but for now, Papa Shango, we bid farewell to you and your voodoo ways. He only lasts 28 seconds here. And I always found it funny, even as a kid, that this poor bastard had to paint up his face and get all this garb on and everything else, and he comes out for 30 seconds, gets tossed, and then he's gone.
That's true, and just gets dumped. At number four, another guy who almost looks like he's dated, I guess, and that is the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. At the time, co-holder of the World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Championships. But still, DiBiase just looks different compared to everybody else.
Yeah, he has a good run here, though. Lasts a good 25 minutes.
Yes, definitely does. At number five, one half of the former World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, and that is Brian Knobbs of the Nasty Boys.
His last appearance.
Yes. More cleansing going on here.
And he would never return. He leaves along with his partner, Jerry Sags, who we'll see later. And they would head to WCW, where they would stay for a long time. They'd be there for a good, like, 4 years as a team. And then when Sags retired, Knobbs would stick around a lot longer as a solo guy until pretty much the promotion folded up. So good run for the Nasties, but, of course, they were held back a little bit towards the end of the run. It looked like they were primed for a big match with Money Inc. heading into WrestleMania. But as we'll see, things definitely changed, and they were shoehorned out of that. And that's when they saw the writing on the wall and decided to leave. So
yep.
That's it for the Nasties.
Yep. Their final pay-per-view record is 1-2?
No, they've had to have been more than that, right?
I don't know.
Well, they
WrestleMania lost... 7, yeah. They won.
Well, Knobs lost in the Rumble 91, if you want to count that. But
they beat the Hart Foundation at WrestleMania 7, lose to
SummerSlam.
Those guys at SummerSlam. Are they at the Survivor Series?
Yeah, their team won. I forget. Okay. I think they both survived.
Okay. So that's what? 2-2. They're not at Tuesday in Texas. 92 Rumble? Are they both in it?
Sags is in it.
Okay. They're at 8, right?
Yep, they lose in the 8-man.
In the 8-man, okay. So that's what? 2-4. They're not at SummerSlam. They are at Survivor Series.
Well, they're in this dark match at SummerSlam. But...
That's right, dark match at SummerSlam. And they're
Survivor
in the...
Series, they won.
Right, so they're what? What I
3-3?
3-3.
Well, it depends if you want to count those rumbles.
Yeah, so. Any event, it's about 500. And the Nasty Boys head off to WCW. So, at number 6, I have a question for you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
How do you spell man?
V-I-R! G-I-L.
Does he still have the face mask on?
No, I think he's done at this point. I think.
Okay, yeah, as he is. Virgil comes in at number 6. So, at number 7... A big debut here. Big debut here. A guy that would end up being an enduring character for pretty much then until now. Modern day. And that is a former AWA champion, a former world-class champion, a 27-time USWA champion or whatever.
8,575,000.
Yeah, bazillion-time champion in Memphis. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Jerry the King Lawler. Makes his debut here at the... Ah, there we are.
Now, of course, we'll give a little more background.
Yes, of course.
He's otherwise known as the King, obviously. Lawler began his career in Memphis in the early 70s, training with the great Jackie Fargo, who he often credits, of course, for all his success. By the late 70s, Lawler was the man in Memphis, winning his top title numerous times, as we talked about. He had a big world title match, NWA world title match with Ric Flair, and would win the AWA world title from Curt Hennig in 1987. He was involved in that big convoluted fucking mess of a merger with the USWA World Class and AWA, where Lawler would actually hold all three of those titles at once, and they had that fucking debacle at Super Clash with Kerry Von Erich.
Yep.
His most high-profile feud, rather, was with comedian Andy Kaufman in 1982, which had the memorable profanity-laced episode of the Late Night with David Letterman show.
Yep.
Where they would smack each other around, Lawler hit him in the face, and then, you know, Kaufman was going to sue him. He had the neck brace on, and they had the match in Memphis and everything else. And great stuff. If you've never seen Man on the Moon, or actually even more historically accurate is... I can't remember if it was on VH1 that had that special. And they used to air it a lot back in the 90s. It was like a two-hour special all about Kaufman and Lawler.
Yeah, I do remember that.
It had all the footage, all the classic footage and everything. Yep. So that's a good piece. And then, of course, the Man in the Moon biopic. They finally revealed the long-standing kayfabe thing that Lawler denied that he knew anything about it and that it was a shoot. Of course, they finally admit that it was all a work, that Lawler and Kaufman were pre-planned and in on it from the start. So
they did a hell of a job, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah, and they defended it for years. So, and that was his big claim to fame at that point. Finally... he comes calling to one of the major promotions. Vince brings him in, debuts on Primetime Wrestling as Bobby Heenan's replacement for Mr. Perfect. So he's on Primetime for its final like 6 weeks or so until it went off the air. And then he would also begin commentary on Superstars as well and would dabble in the ring from time to time. Mainly over the next like 4 years, it'd be, I don't know, probably like semi full time, I guess, as a wrestler, just kind of feud to feud. So he would continue to work in Memphis as well because he owned the USWA. So, co-owned and co-ran with Jerry Jarrett. So, the King debuts, and of course, he'll be a lasting icon as we go through these shows.
Yes, exactly. And eventually, I think Vince kind of helps out in Memphis.
It was actually during 1993 that he would show up in Memphis as a heel.
Yes, they would share talent. It would actually become kind of a AAA.
Yeah.
For a lot of his guys.
Yeah,
including Owen.
A lot of talent that wasn't currently being used would go down there to stay busy. Papa Shango went down there. I think he actually had a run as champion, him and Owen.
Yep.
So a lot of guys would go down there, work out, and then eventually come back up or, you know, however they wanted to do it. So
apparently I've heard that they had actually pretty good feud down there, Owen and Papa Shango, over the USWA, whatever the hell, Southern Heavyweight title or something like that.
Yep, they definitely did. And Vince's heel work, if you've never seen that, I mean, I'll try and get the clip and put it on the Facebook page, but Vince went down there and cut an awesome promo as a heel, ripping on Lawler and everything else. So it was really cool stuff. They had a lot of little hidden feuds going on down there in Memphis at this time.
Mm. Yes. So there he is. The King makes his WWE debut and joins us.
And it looks like, we'll get to in a minute, but it looks like they were setting him up for a pretty major feud at the time.
Yes. Yes, they were. We'll get to that in a moment. At number eight is, for me, one of the most unusual characters, and a guy that I don't totally know much about. He always seems to fly under my wrestling radar. And I'm talking about the character known as Max Moon.
All right, Max Moon.
Help me out here, because I can't even give you a direct description. I barely remember who the hell he was, to be honest with you.
The original Max Moon was actually named the Comet Kid. That was the name that was given to him on his first, like when they said, next week we have the debut of a new star, the Comet Kid. And then when he showed up the next week, his name was Max Moon. Maximilian Moon was the full name. Mm. The gimmick is originally created for Mexican star Conan. He's supposed to come in with his gimmick. But he was actually got to a fight and left after backstage disagreement. He left the WWF. There's some backstage convoluted story with him. Let me see if I can find it. I think he was banging someone's wife or girlfriend or something, and he had an issue and then he left. Let me see if I can find. Approached by talent scout Patterson. Conan spent 8 months in the American WWF as Max Moon in 92. See, now, according to this, I didn't think he actually wrestled as Max Moon. The Moon character created by Conan was that of a cyborg who wore an outfit purchased at WWF at a cost of $1,300, bedecked with circuitry and a pyrotechnic gun. During his approach to the ring, Conan was given many ring names, including his own name, the Comet Kid, Maximilian Moves, Electrico, and eventually Max Moon. His character hailed from the future or outer space. His entrance music was a techno song, and his finishing move was a flying body press. His attire was blue leather, silver foam tubing, and a mask. And on his way, he shot sparkles into the crowd. He debuted on September 1st, 92, that fateful Hershey, Pennsylvania show that we've talked so much about.
Yep.
Under the name Comet Kid, he pinned Dwayne Gill. After three TV matches, Conan left following a disagreement with Vince McMahon. Conan believed he was being discriminated against and resented McMahon's refusal to give him a guaranteed contract. And the Max Moon gimmick was then given to Paul Diamond. And Paul Diamond worked it for a while into early 93. And then Diamond's contract was up in February. They didn't renew it, and the Max Moon character slowly disappeared into the background. But this is its only pay-per-view debut. He was actually on the first Raw as well. He lost to Shawn Michaels in an IC title match.
Hmm.
So then from there on out, he's pretty much just a jobber to the stars outside of this match. So there is all you ever needed to know about Maximilian Moon.
Okay. Good, because you've educated me, because I don't ever think about him in the wrestling pantheon. But there he is.
Nor should you.
Yeah. At number nine, legendary tag team partner of Fred Katau, and that is Tenayru.
We need Fred Katau to make another appearance.
I think so, too. I don't know why. I'm surprised he called him and not Fred Katau to be in this match.
Disappointments.
At number 10 is a guy who we were just talking about earlier, who ends up having a huge match the next night on Raw, but actually has one of his most productive years here, and that is, of course, Mr. Perfect.
Yes. Now, as we talked about, he was the guy that Lex Luger, as we heard earlier, called out. So it looked like they were starting a feud with... They were transitioning Perfect eventually from your boy Ric Flair to Luger.
Mm-hmm.
Also, though, it looks like they were starting to tease a little bit of a Perfect-Jerry Lawler feud here, because Perfect ends up tossing Lawler out, but then Lawler pulls Perfect, distracts him and ends up having him get tossed out as well. And then they fight all the way to the back. So it looked like maybe they were teasing a feud between those two based off Lawler being kind of associated with Heenan. Heenan was kind of in a weird spot. He had like these loose associations with guys in 1993. He was kind of associated with Luger, associated with Lawler. Even though he wasn't really managing them, he was kind of like advisor to them. So it seemed like they were both gunning for Perfect. But obviously nothing really comes of that. So
no. But Perfect would end up having a pretty good year.
I remember being really surprised as a kid that he was in and out so quick in this match. It seemed like, you know, he's getting such a big push that I was shocked that he was eliminated so quickly. And I had him pegged, I remember at the time, because we used to do little pay-per-view picks at our house. And amongst me and my cousin and my mom, you know, I used to make my mom and dad do it as well. But I definitely remember having Mr. Perfect winning this, so I remember being shocked that he was eliminated so quickly by Lawler.
It would have been a pretty good title match.
Yeah.
WrestleMania. Right. Well, obviously.
Well, honestly, I remember I picked Razor Ramon. I thought he was going to win the title. So I think I had Perfect Ramon as the title match at WrestleMania as a kid.
Which actually, also, not that bad.
Yeah.
At number 11, another kind of leftover from the tail end of the Federation years, and that is Skinner.
This is it for him.
Yeah, this is pretty much, he's pretty much done from there. Steve Kern will return backstage. I believe he ends up being an agent for a few years.
Yeah, he still is, right?
Yeah, I believe he still is.
He went to WCW, actually, in 94.
Oh, okay.
Worked with Bobby Eaton as a tag team at Bad Attitude. And he left by the end of 94, just kind of bounced around a little bit. And then became an agent and has mainly trains wrestlers and runs his own developmental promotion now. So,
at number 12...
You knew we had to get one last appearance of the bird.
See, you think I'm the one that's only that's supposed to be sad today. Both of us are very sad tonight.
Oh, poor Coco.
Yeah. Energy.
Energy. We leave the WWF after some issues, and of course, the well-documented in Beyond the Mat, where he had a fight with some backstage agent or something, and Vince had to let him go. So he made a few appearances in the AWF as well as USWA, and then he retired in 95. Of course, he would return on TV in a much different role in 1999 to the WWF. 2003, he would return to the spotlight, worked in Memphis a little bit. So, you know, he's been sporadic, typical, legend guy, kind of. In and out of the indie spotlight, in and out of the main spotlight here and there.
Right.
So eventually we'll be inducted to the Hall of Fame as well. So
at number 13, one half of one of the newer hot teams in the company, Samu of the Head Shrinkers. At number 14, another one of JR's favorites, and that's Berserker the Bum.
Also his final appearance.
This is, you know, you're telling me that I'm the one crying. This is a pretty sad show for you, too. Some of your favorites kind of... going off into the sunset.
Yeah, sad day.
You know?
The Berserker. Let's see what his story is when he left. Of course, the accomplice of Hawk, the accomplice of Nails. Surprising he lasted as long as he did. He went to All Japan in 94, stayed there in 97. He showed up at WCW as a jobber to the stars, working mainly Saturday night. Actually, had a long winning streak on Saturday night and ended in a match with Bill Goldberg on Nitro. Kind of surprising. Mm-hmm. He would retire and now owns now works at his brother's auto dealership in Minnesota.
Now, I would buy a car from that dealership if John Norris dressed as the Berserker.
Yes.
Think
obviously.
About it. Wouldn't you like the Berserker to sell you a car? Hell yeah.
I would like him to drive me home in it.
Oh, that would be tremendous. Fuzzy boots and all. Huss! At number 15 is a guy that many probably thought was a favorite at the time to win the Rumble, one of the few favorites, and that, of course, is The Undertaker.
And now another guy, like Perfect, like Flair, you expect will last for a while because they wanted the heavy hitters in at the end.
Right.
But 4 minutes into his run here, he eliminates a few guys, tosses out Samu, Berserker, your boy Tenryu.
Yep.
DiBiase, who lasted 25 minutes. Just it looks like he was about to win the match, dominate the match, tosses Berserker out. I don't know how to explain this.
Yeah, I got it.
Oh my God, what is that? Wait a minute! Who is that? Oh no! What is it? How big is that guy? Looks like he's 20, 30 feet tall. Look at this. Look at the size of that monster. What is it? That is the biggest man I have ever seen in my life. B-5-0-5. He is a Wall Street runner. The Undertaker.
another participant about to come down, but Damian Demento, I understand, is on his way, but who is this guy,
man? I do not know.
Mr. Broadcast Journalist.
Look at this.
He is dwarfing The Undertaker. The Undertaker is about 6'10", 6'11". Beating The Undertaker to the punch. He is gone.
Of course, this man is known here as the Giant Gonzalez, mm-hmm. led by Harvey Whippleman. Now, Harvey had promised a couple days before that he wanted revenge on The Undertaker due to the way he ruined Kamala.
Yep.
And he vowed that he would get his revenge at the Royal Rumble. So we're all kind of waiting to see what would happen. And he comes out here out of nowhere with this giant man, 7 feet tall. Or, I'm sorry, almost 8 feet tall, 7'7", in a giant furry suit that was made to look like his naked body. He lumbers down to the ring and beats the shit out of The Undertaker. Leaves him laid out. First time in a long time, ever maybe, that we've seen this happen. Taker was really, really hurt. They hit him with the urn. They knock Paul Bearer down. And Taker's left laying after they eliminate him. Of course, Giant Gonzalez, portrayed by Jorge Gonzalez. He was an Argentinian basketball player. Mm-hmm. Played well for their team in 1985 and 1988 tournaments. He attracted the attention of the Atlanta Hawks scouts. In the third round of the NBA draft in 1988, the Hawks actually bought his rights from Argentina. They drafted him. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as many who have seen his frame could see, he was not really cut out for the rigorous NBA. So
no, he was a little gangly. So
having him already been paying him and not knowing what to do with him, Ted Turner said, "Hey, why don't you try wrestling with my WCW?" Because obviously he owned the Hawks as well. So mm-hmm. he trained for a year on May 19th, 1990, debuted as El Gigante, wore shorts.
Gigante.
Gigante?
Yeah, El Gigante.
Gigante?
Yep.
What did I say? Gigante?
Gigante.
Gigante?
Sounds like a midget guy. Sounds like a midget playing basketball.
Sounds like the Montreal version of Gigante.
It's Gigante. The Rougeau version.
Gigante.
Gigante.
So Gigante here. Yeah. He competed as a fan favorite for over the next 2 years. Had some very interesting stints and matches. Yep. So eventually he would leave in 1992. Showed up in WWF in 1993 here. So he will have a very interesting run over 1993, but we'll cover that as we go. So, but here he makes a memorable debut, wiping out the invincible Undertaker.
Yes. And that leads to a feud.
Get your
beer. Yeah. Get your beers ready, because you might want to be a little inebriated watching this feud. More on that next week. At number 16 is the returning, however, with his real name, Terry Taylor.
Yes.
Of course. I like your reference. The last time we saw him, he was clucking his way to the ring. At which Rumble was it?
1990. Went back to WCW for a little while. Moderate success there, not much. He's a tailor-made man, and he was part of the
Foundation.
York Foundation. Yep. But he showed back up here in mid to late 92 as terrific Terry Taylor, and it wouldn't really do much. Just was kind of a lower mid-card guy throughout early 93. Then he became an interviewer and just kind of a jack of all trades in that regard, and would leave toward the end of the year. So not much going on for terrific Terry Taylor. It was good to see him back in a serious role, but I think it was just too little too late for him at this point.
Yeah, it's a shame, because if anyone has watched him, even as far back as 1985-86 when he was in the NWA in Mid-Atlantic, guy's a really good wrestler, and it's a shame. And he would be a backstage influence in multiple promotions over the next 15 years from this point. Although I think he goes back and wrestles, right, in WCW?
Yeah, yep, he would for a little while.
But then, again, would become one of the more well-known backstage road agents in WWE, WCW, and TNA. So, but that is it for Terry Taylor in the ring right here. Big laundry list of departures here.
Yeah, and debuts. A lot going on.
A lot going on here. Remember earlier on in the program, I gave out the trivia question, who was in the main event of the very first Monday Night Raw on January 11th, 1993? Well, one half was The Undertaker. His opponent is the guy that comes out at number 17, and that is the unusual character known as Damien Demento.
Yes. Now, Damien Demento, portrayed by Philip Feese, made his debut after training with the unpredictable Johnny Rods in 1987, worked the indie circuit. He was actually kind of a well-known indie guy, Mondo Clean. He used to pop up a lot in PWI and those other publications. Kind of a mysterious guy, yep. Weird-looking guy. I always kind of wonder. I think he had his face painted, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it did. He did have his face painted.
So, interesting. He would work, Memphis and other indies. The Bushwhackers, Luke and Butch, your boys, they helped him get a job with the WWF. He worked as Mondo Clean on live events and then made his televised in-ring debut as Damien Demento. On October 28th, 1992, defeated Jim Brunzell at Wrestling Challenge. He was hailed from the outer reaches of your mind. And I'm sorry, that Jim Brunzell match was later. His first match, he defeated Steve May. So his highlights are pretty much losing to Undertaker on that Raw and then the Rumble here. And for the rest of 93, he'd work the house shows, work the indie independent circuit after this when he left, and then would eventually retire and go on to become an insane YouTube video maker.
He's an absolute freak show.
Yeah, he is.
Wonders why he never gets invited back to do...
Yeah, because no one remembers you other than guys like us who obsess and do these reviews.
Exactly. And talk about these matches.
Yes.
So no one cares about you. Move on. It's kind of like Billy Jack Heen.
I'm surprised Russo hasn't brought him back to TNA for a stint.
Yeah, why not? Sure. Everybody else is back there for one shots that they overpay for. At number 18, the other half of your World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, Erwin R. Scheister, a.k.a. IRS. And they've been champs now. They're hitting their stride here as a championship tag team.
Yep, champs since October. Of course, yep. Other than just that little three-month blip, they pretty much dominated the tag scene. So,
yep. Good for both of them. Mm-hmm. They've earned it. At number 19... Absolutely hideous.
Simon Cowell, the man.
Yeah. Are you co-hosting the premiere of X Factor this week?
Well, I'm hoping someone should go on and perform some of these songs on that show.
Oh,
perform,
yeah.
The whole album for him.
William Hung sings the Tatanka theme. Great. Or the guy that sings the, what is it, get on your, or put your pants, foot in your pants, or whatever the stupid guy was that sang on that American Idol. Anyway, we're talking, of course, about Tatanka, who's red hot right now, continues to be a winner.
Yep, undefeated.
In WWE, and he comes in at number 19, and things look up for him over the next couple of months. So, Tatanka comes in at number 19. At number 20, second half of a team, a former championship team, that is Jerry Sags of the Nasty Boys. Knobs was in earlier. At number 22, at number 21, one half of the Natural Disasters, another tag team, and that is Typhoon.
And this is actually his final pay-per-view appearance.
Yes. Uncle Fred bids farewell here.
His tag team partner would take a leave shortly after the show. Typhoon actually hung around through the summer, or spring into the summer, as a, usual, what these guys would be, low-level jobber to the stars. Eventually would head to WCW. Of course, the infamous Shockmaster incident.
Yes.
That he wrestled as... Uncle Fred for a while. So, and then he was eventually abandoned. He would return to WWF in 1984 as a jobber to the stars again, just on TV. Doesn't make another pay-per-view appearance. And eventually, of course, we'll do a little appearances here and there for the promotion. But he pretty much retired altogether. So now lives in Florida. He also coaches Little League team of his two sons. And that's that.
Yep. And he goes over to the Rhodes house every Christmas and Dusty kicks his ass. So someday they'll work that out.
Someday.
Who he gets eliminated by? Guy coming up in a moment. First of all, number 22 is the other half of the Head Shrinkers, Fatu. Fatu. Let's see, it's not the same as Haku.
No, not at all.
Not the same. And number 23, as mentioned, the other half of the Natural Disasters, and that is, of course, the beloved Earthquake.
And he would leave the night after the show. He lost to Bam Bam Bigelow that he left for Japan. He would return to WWF in 1994, so we'll see him again on pay-per-view, but he's gone now for another year.
Yeah, we won't get into his. Yeah, we won't get into the end of him.
No, we got some time for that.
Yeah. At number 24,
youngster.
Exactly, a guy you've never seen before, brand new to the World Wrestling Federation.
This young talent that Gorilla Monsoon raves about. This the youngster, Carlos Colon.
Youngster, a crisp, no caffeine, 49 years old. Actually, he might even be older than that.
Well, he was born in 1948.
All right. Well, let's do the math. 48 and 88 is 40. He's 45.
All right. He says, how old were you at take away like 20?
Well, let's see. Toots and I, him and Vern Gagne. It was about that.
Okay.
Yeah, he's about
so,
the same.
There you go.
Carlos Colon.
Yes. Of course, big name in Puerto Rico. Yep. Ran his own promotion there at WWC. He had a little run in the NWA. Very good wrestler for that area and that era. I can't say I was ever really seen much of his work or too into him. But
only match that I think I've ever seen of him is when he fought actually at, I believe it was Starrcade 83. He takes on
Abdullah.
Probably his most hated and world-renowned rival. I mean, no, I don't think there was a bloodier feud in this world in history of wrestling than Carlos Colon and Abdullah the Butcher, who just used to fork the crap out of each other in matches. I mean, forks and knives and chair pieces and hot pokers and cattle prods and Jesus knows what else they killed each other with. But they feuded literally from like 74 to like 90. I mean, literally 16 years all over the world of just absolutely annihilating each other.
Yep, and shortly after his appearance here, he temporarily retired, starting to train his sons, who we'll get to know someday in the future. But for now, this youngster makes his one appearance here in the WWF and then moves on.
Yes. At number 25, not a departure per se, but the last official pay-per-view appearance of Tito Santana.
Sad. AKA, yep. Very sad. He's had quite the run.
Yep. Another guy that we see the end of the Federation years here. Another epilogue.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of these guys just kind of put the nail in the coffin of that era.
Yep.
We had him for a long... we haven't done pay-per-view without him, really. So he had a long, illustrious run. Mm-hmm. Was IC champ, tag champ. A lot of good feuds, a lot of good matches. He's kind of been tailing off here in 92 and 93. After losing here, he would stick around on television through 1993. He would, of course... Wrestle a lot on TV, actually. There's no more pay-per-views. And his final match, it's actually pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. In his final appearance on WWF program, Santana defeated friend and frequent tag team partner Virgil on a 1993 episode of Challenge, and as a sign of mutual respect between the two, both men embraced after the match. So, kind of interesting there. And he would, of course, work ECW when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling, the AWF, in one appearance in WCW. And then he would return later in the 90s as the Spanish commentary partner for WWF for a while as well. So
yes,
but as far as wrestling goes, he's done with WWF from here. So farewell, Tito. Thank you for all the memories.
Yes, you were reliable. You were solid in the ring, never disappointing. You were always a good trooper. So be very sorely missed. When we see some holes in some of these pay-per-views over the next couple of years, we'll wish you were there. At number 26, speak of the devil, his former Strike Force partner and Royal Rumble stalwart, to use that word often this evening. Ricky Martel, the model, comes in at 26, and he hangs around in this match for a while again.
Yeah,
I believe, 12
minutes. He's almost until the end, pretty much.
Yeah. At number 27, the big guy, as
Yakazuma.
As Gorilla Monsoon would call him, the big guy, Yakazuma.
Now remember, Virgil issued the warning at Survivor Series. We had to be prepared for this.
Exactly. So this should be no surprise to anyone if you were paying attention. Yokozuna comes in at number 27 and just lays waste.
Yes.
But we'll get to more on him in a minute. At number 28, making his pay-per-view debut, his Royal Rumble debut, and that is, of course, the Rocket, Owen Hart, who Brett's little brother, who took a beating at the hands of Razor Ramon just before this show.
And he actually takes a nasty fall from the ring when Yoko eliminates him. He falls really awkwardly on his knee, and looking at it, I remember at the time thinking, wow, this guy's really fucked. He wouldn't really miss any time, but it definitely looked like a bad injury.
Mm. Kind of like the way Cena fell out of the ring.
Yeah, very similar.
During the 04 Rumble, when it looks like he blows his knee to pieces. At number 29, another guy we say goodbye to, and you mentioned this at the Survivor Series, and that is the Repo Man.
Yep, he would have a little mini angle with Macho Man on Raw after this at the end of January, and then after losing that match, his final match after working TV for a while would be on March 28th. He'd lose to Typhoon. Mm-hmm. He worked the Indies for a while, then he headed to WCW, and we talked about all the characters who was there. So, farewell, Repo.
Yes. Another symbol of the Federation years going out the back door. And finally, at number 30, and here's another guy that you'd think would be a heavy favorite to win this match. And that is the Macho Man.
Yeah, at this point, you're thinking, all right, he's going to be a major favorite, obviously. Taker's gone, Perfect's gone, Flair's gone. We really only have Yoko and Savage left as the two guys who could legitimately win this thing. Although there was one other guy lingering. Of course, that's Bob Backlund. Came in at number two. And throughout all the chaos, he hung on and hung on. And when Giant Gonzalez came out, he was unconscious on the floor thanks to the Berserker. Gets back in the ring and hangs on. His total runtime, he'd last for an hour and 1 minute until Yokozuna finally eliminated him. And, of course, he would set the new record, beating Ric Flair's record from the year before. So yep. Bob Backlund is your new Royal Rumble longevity record holder.
Yep, 61 minutes. Yeah, he said 61 minutes and 10 seconds. Then the drama kind of settles in here. You're not sure who's going to win what. But I thought at 30, Savage was going to win. He was my pick. Because I think Brett Savage would have been a great world title match at WrestleMania.
Yeah. I definitely thought at that point, too, he had a shot. The final four, of course, Martel, Backlund, Savage, and Yoko. So, obviously, Savage and Yoko were the two obvious choices. Although Backlund, you know, kind of hanging around. But Backlund would toss Martel, Yoko would toss Backlund to a big boo from the crowd, and then he gets a nice little reaction. So he actually did a nice job establishing Backlund here. And then Yoko and Savage, of course, the whole story here is that Yoko had never been knocked down, and he goes for his little butt splash in the corner. Savage avoids him, and Yoko crashes to the mat the first time he's off his feet. But, of course, still no one had knocked him down. He knocked himself down. Savage I think he hits him with the elbow, and then for some reason he tries to pin him, which is bizarre because...
Yeah, I thought that was weird too.
You would think Savage has been enough rumbles that he would know. Now, of course, he doesn't have the best track record. The year before, he dove over the top rope and basically eliminated himself. And now this time, he is goes for the pin, and Yoko presses him off his chest and out to the floor in a cool spot. So Yokozuna is your winner of the 1993 Royal Rumble. He will earn the world title shot against Bret Hart at WrestleMania. Mr. Fuji comes in, hands him the check. I don't know. I forget if Caesar comes out. I think he does.
Yeah, I think he does, too.
And they play the little Caesar music.
Yeah.
Of course, we have the stats here. Longest time, Bob Backlund, 61:10. Shortest time, Terry Taylor, not so terrific, at 24 seconds. And most eliminated, Yokozuna at 8. So,
Yokozuna.
There you go. There is your 1993 Royal Rumble. Hot crowd. You know, I think the show is often actually hurt more by its predecessor the year before. Because 1992 was such a great Rumble show. This one's kind of, I don't know, can't really live up to that hype. But I think the show itself, if you watch it, is pretty solid.
Yeah, I never really had a problem with it. I gave it a C. I guess underwhelming is a pretty good description.
Yeah, definitely. It feels, yeah, I was trying to think of the word. It feels underwhelming or a little antiseptic compared to the hype and nonsense and craziness of 1992 with all the loaded main eventers and the Flair story and Heenan freaking out and all that stuff. When you compare it to that, it definitely is feeling a little lacking.
Well, I think the key point there is, and we talked about it, we've been talking about it throughout the show, is the roster. In 1992, yeah. I mean, that Rumble was friggin' loaded with heavyweights. I mean, big-time players. Here, you've got, you know, a few, but mostly it's kind of afterthoughts and guys out the door. And, I mean, nothing really fancy, you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't think the show is bad. Like I said, if you find somehow, if you don't have the Digipack or the anthology version, try and find the Brett Razor match. It's very good. Very good. Sean and Marty, not as good as you would hope it would be. And then the rest of the undercard is kind of there. So it's a very straight down the middle pay-per-view. It's not offensively terrible, but it's not the greatest thing on earth either.
Right.
This is one of those shows that you kind of formulate your own opinion on and don't really listen to anybody else. I mean, we'd love for you, we thank you for listening to our show, but don't take our word for it. This is one of those shows where you might want to watch it yourself and think, you know, this show's not bad, or wow, this show sucks ass. You know, it's totally up to you. Totally up to you.
Yeah, I say we find out exactly what the nation has to say about it. Let's see what their thoughts are.
Exactly. So let's go to, we'll go to our page first, Place to Be podcast page.
You gotta scroll down quite a bit.
Yeah, I found it. Okay. I found it earlier, so I got it. It actually opens with you, you posted the...
No, that was actually Graham.
Oh, Graham did that. Okay.
Yep. So Graham, you can posted... start with Eric Cafiero.
All right. Eric Cafiero. This show is nowhere near as good as last year. Brett vs. Razor was good, but was dull. And yes, it was stupid of Macho Man to try and pin Yoko, but it was cool when Yoko bench-pressed Macho over, up and over the top rope. Yes, it was.
Matt Souza. I thought the Romo match itself was a little too predictable. With the way they were pushing Yokozuna at the time, it was almost a given that he was going to win, as other men in the Romo weren't really main event caliber. With the exception of Macho Man and Undertaker, I mean, we're really supposed to believe that Max Moon was going to win the Rumble. Overall, an enjoyable show and a good blast for the past.
Well, come on. Guess it's been a little disbelief there, Matt. Jordan McKinnon. A rare Rumble where the undercard easily outshines the Rumble match itself. This might have been a good time to start double dipping. The undercard was full of solid workers, but with a thin roster, it meant the Rumble itself was very predictable. I think 2/3 of the Jobber Hall of Fame is in this match. I think, realistically, there were three possible winners of this match. Taker, Savage, and Yoko. Marks at the time could have expanded. Oh, may I say that again? Mox at the time could have expanded. We'll get more to that later in the week. Expanded that list out to include Flair and Perfect, but they obviously weren't going to win it in hindsight. Throwing some of the undercard guys in this Rumble would have made it more interesting than resorting to the youngster Carlos Colon and Fred Katao's partner. Cheesy finish that made Savage look ridiculous by going for the pin after the big elbow. Big thing I'll remember about this match is Bob Backlund's marathon run. Good show. Less than memorable Rumble.
Graham the Broham. I'd argue it wasn't a given Yoko to win. The guy had been on TV 3 months and hadn't been tested. Macho was a strong candidate, plus you've got the returning Mr. Perfect and Undertaker as contenders. And Ric Flair. Yeah, Flair was on his way out, but unless you're reading the dirt sheets at the time, you wouldn't have known. And Flair was still chasing Brett for the title of house shows. I definitely agree that Yoko wasn't as obvious in retrospect, he's very obvious, but at the time he definitely wasn't. I agree with Graham. But I think it was pretty obvious that Flair was probably on his way out, mainly because they had already booked the Loser Leaves Town match, and it was unlikely that Perfect was leaving. And it was kind of obvious from the booking that Flair was probably the one that was going to go. And I remember even, I mean, I wasn't inside at all at this point. I think I was calling the Province Journal Journal line, so I had a little bit of a hint here and there. But I agree with Graham on one hand as far as Yoko, but not on the other with Brett.
Right. Kieran Polland?
Ah, Scott.
There you go. Not a bad show as we head into a year that would bring many changes to the WWF. The Steiners make their debut, and Scott gives us a glimpse of the future 10 years from now as he nearly kills one of the Beverlys with a Frankensteiner. Shawn Marty is a great match, and seeing how good Marty was drunk, imagine what he could have been like sober when we went into that whole story. There's a story going around that Marty was supposed to win the title from Shawn at the show, but he showed up drunk and they changed the finish of the match to Shawn retaining. Fine by me anyway, because Shawn was on a good run right there. Bossman Bigelow is meh. As we bid farewell to the law enforcer from Cowd County for 5 years and welcome back the Beast from the East after 5 years away. The Brett Razor match is tremendous and needs to be looked at. It's really fun, and Brett really showed how versatile he was by heading into the ring with Shawn at the previous pay-per-view and then working with a big guy like Razor at the next. The Rumble match is good, but it was going to be difficult to follow up from the previous year's Rumble. Flair leaves the WWF for 8 years, and Scott needs to cry into the warm, loving arms of... I think I would rather be choked up. Yoko's tight. Than ever being in this guy's arms. Please, Kieran. Why do you do this to me? You slay me, kid. Coco Beware leaves as well, causing Justin to embrace Frenchie Martin and George Steele to calm himself down. Go ahead. Where's the French national anthem? Yeah, didn't think so. And George Steele doesn't have any music, so. Gonzalez making his debut was fine, although you could have to feel bad for – you have to feel bad for Taker knowing that he would have to carry this lump of meat for the next 8 months. I've never heard him refer to that. That's pretty funny. Lump of meat. The standoff between Yoko and Earthquake was a nice visual, and Backlund's marathon run is amazing considering his age. One of my favorite Rumble moments is near the end when Backlund eliminates Martel, realizes how far he's actually gone in the match, and the crowd pops huge for him. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool little face he makes, like, what the fuck, you know.
I know. Yoko winning the match gives him a huge rub, although I do have a problem with Macho trying to pin him after the elbow. Maybe a way of explaining that it was Yoko beat him up so bad that he forgot what type of match he was in.
I guess.
Overall, a decent show that is quite underlooked.
Jason Greenhouse, the master of the Photoshop, who did another brilliant piece of me and Coco Beware.
Yes.
This show had a stronger undercard than the Rumble match. I was never a big fan of the Steiner Brothers, but it was good to see a couple of fresh faces in the tag division. I liked the opener between them and the Beverly. Sean and Marty had the first of many awesome matches together. Sherry's involvement added to an already good storyline between the former tag partners. Brett and Razor put on one of the best matches of the year. Bossman and Bam Bam are two of the best big men ever and had a decent match. I guess I should mention the debuts of the Narcissist. Okay, there, I mentioned it. How Scott feels about Jim Duggan is how I feel about Lex Luger. On to the Rumble match. Let's see here. Max Moon, Terry Taylor, Typhoon, Virgil, Skinner, Damian Demento, Tenryu, Carlos Colon. Yes, fans included. Myself actually paid to see these men in the Rumble. The debut of the Giant Gonzalez still makes me laugh to this day. I love seeing Bob Backlund returning around this time making his Rumble debut. A sad day for Scott as we say goodbye to the Nature Boy and the WWF on pay-per-view until 2002. As I mentioned in the Survivor Series 92 review, I had a feeling Yokozuna was going to go on to big things and continued this night. Bobby Heenan has the line of the night when Coco Beware comes out with his checkered pants and Bobby says, did somebody call a cab?
Absolutely. Jared Incel. I've only seen this Royal Rumble pay-per-view once, and considering that I have not watched it since, it's obvious that this show is not one of my favorites. It's never a good thing when the undercard is way better than the Rumble, which is supposed to be the centerpiece of these events, yet even the undercard looks better on paper than how it played out. Yes, we have solid Brett vs. Razor and Sean vs. Marty bouts, but these guys would have far better matches with each other down the road. On a side note, depending on who you believe, either Marty or Sean was apparently shit-faced during their match. At any rate, the incident got Jannetty fired. Perhaps the most disturbing moment on the show is when Bobby Heenan unveils the narcissist Lex Luger and uncharacteristically fawns over him. It's a very bizarre segment to kick off Luger's underwhelming WWF run. All in all, the 1993 Royal Rumble was probably the worst up to that point in time, and while there will be worse Rumbles in the coming years, this one takes the taco for now.
Neil Trauma. After a great 1992, I don't know what happened to WWF to deliver this stinker. Sean and Marty is a disappointment, and the Rumble is a big bore. I can't say I hate the show, but nothing makes me want to watch it ever again.
Wow. Austin Pfaff. Funny story I have about this event. I had a taped from pay-per-view copy of this event, which is actually the kind I have. Suddenly one day I no longer had it, but had an episode of As the World Turns. Mystery was never solved. Interesting. I love this event. Solid opener with two good teams. Sean Marty was a great match. Not sure why it never made any DVDs. Wow, first one to give that match love. I heard once that Sean showed up to this match drunk, and if this was true, certainly didn't show it. Nice little reintroduction to Bam Bam Bigelow. Brett Razor was a great match as well, another match that's been shunned from DVDs. I concur, Austin. Rumble match is underrated. Backlund going the distance was good storytelling, and all due respect to Savage, but what the heck was he thinking? A pinfall, really. I wonder what would happen. Do you think he really just brain farted? He had to have.
What do you mean, kayfabe-wise, storyline-wise?
Yeah, like, what would make... Like, do you think he just literally forgot what kind of match it was, or do you think they told him, do a pin so we could see
Yoko's power? Yeah, I think that's all he did. I don't think he forgot forgot, no.
Yeah, I
think it was part of the story. Nunez. Kind of a mess show, really there to set up WrestleMania 9, if anything else, so I don't really have anything to say about it. Although there was yet another great classic one-liner from The Brain. I forgot what the setup was, but I think it was Gorilla asking Bobby if he thinks Stu Hart said anything to Brett before his match with Razor. And Bobby responded, I think he said, well, And Gorilla responded back with his famous, will you stop?
You do a very good Stu, by the way. Just let you know.
Yeah, shut up. Fucking old piece of shit.
Dave Hall. After last year's phenomenal Rumble, this one is very different. With only two or three real potential winners here, the Rumble match felt a little flat. I was disappointed Perfect went out before the end, and after Undertaker's exit, I really felt it really left only two potential winners. I did like the Savage help Yoko look awesome with the big kickout elimination. Brett vs. Razor was solid. Sean and Marty finally get to wrestle, but it was 9 months later than it should have been. The Steiner's debut was also solid, but with three or the better performers in the undercard and not doing double duty, it just seemed to dilute the Rumble match.
Ryan Samick, Rumble 93 is basically a two-shot show. For me, the WWF title match and the IC title match. Razor and Brett bring it pretty well in this one. Put on a great show that makes you think Razor has a real shot, as I wasn't 100% convinced of Brett as champ yet. Sean and Marty do what they do best, wrestle well. This would be the worst of their matches for 93, and it's still a pretty good show. Didn't Vince ream them out after this for a bad show or something once they go backstage? The Rumble itself blows, but I don't like Battle Royals to begin with, and not having much star power hurt this one. True, Taker, Flair, Perfect Savage all had shots, but the match wasn't booked well, in my opinion.
I don't know if Vince reamed them out. Probably not. I think that,
I think they definitely knew that it wasn't that great of a match, but
right, that it was much worse than it was supposed to be. I'm sure it was underwhelming. Next up, the master of the apostrophe, and certainly not Matt Rotella, but J. Arsenio D'Amato. Gorilla and the Brain together for the last time. So sad. We concur. Gorilla affectionately threatened to knock him out about 10 times during the pay-per-view. A few gems from the best broadcasting duo of all time, Gorilla. Stu and Helen are looking anxious at ringside. Brain. They know if their punk kid loses the belt, they will have to pay for their own meal. During the Rumble, Brain asked, is Backlund still in there? Every couple of minutes. When Gorilla called IRS stupid for wearing a tie in the ring, Brain replied, you're definitely getting audited. Future commentary on pay-per-views will never match this duo. I absolutely concur. They definitely brought the goods here. They definitely did the best they could to kind of sauce this match up, because there wasn't much to bring. So thank you, J. Arsenio.
Ryan Howard, Brian and Gorilla, end of an era. Opener was solid, as it was the final time one of my favorite teams, the Bevs, were on pay-per-view. HBK Marty was great, but I thought the end was sort of lame. Bossman Bigelow should have been on a Coliseum video release. I know it was to get Bigelow over, but even though Bossman was on his way out, it made him look super weak coming off Survivor Series win against Nails. Brett Razor is very underrated. I feel world title matches on Rumble cards tend to get overshadowed by the Rumble itself. Onto the Rumble, maybe next to 95, this was the least star-studded Rumble. Regardless, being a sucker for early 90s WWF nostalgia, this match does hold a special place in my heart. It'll be the last time we see certain gimmicks, such as Berserker, Max Moon, Demento, Coco, Taylor, Nasties, El Matador, Skinner. I'll end by saying Macho trying to pin Yoko was the dumbest thing ever, and Heenan drooling over Luger is the gayest thing ever. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Respect the Seinfeld reference.
And finally, quick Dave Hall comes back with, almost forgot about the other two debuts, Lex Luger's mind-numbingly slow segment, and Giant Gonzalez's ridiculous hairy costume, which, of course, we did mention. So we thank our loyal friends of PTB Nation. Why don't we move on to the Broham, Graham Cawthon's History of WWE Facebook page. Let's see.
All right, I'll start it off while you're looking. Matt Farrell, I feel like a veteran of many Rumbles, like Savage, looked like an idiot going for a pinfall on Yokozuna. Still looking?
Here it is. Found it. Okay, there we go. Okay, Paul Frazier. Savage should have won then versus Bret Hart at WrestleMania 9.
All right, Dan Silvestri. Rumble 93 had a good undercard, but the Rumble match was okay at best. There wasn't enough top guys in the Rumble to make it noteworthy. For the talent that was in the match, it wasn't bad, just not great. I agree with Matt. The ending with Savage trying to pin Yoko was really stupid.
Okay. Of course, the head of WWE, the Broham himself, Graham Cawthon. Savage's pin attempt on Yoko was over the top bad. The way he was booked in his final years in the WWF, no wonder he jumped to WCW. Going into the show, I saw Razor as a real threat to the Hitman and Marty as a threat to Sean. Bam Bam's win over Bossman really cemented him as a monster heel. Bossman rarely lost on pay-per-view, as we pointed out. Mm-hmm. Savage winning and facing Brett at WrestleMania with Brett going over would have elevated both men and would have made a crappy WrestleMania into at least an average to good one. Instead, the only Brett Savage title match we ever got was in Japan the following year.
Yes.
I didn't know that. Is that match on anything? Probably not.
I don't remember. It could be on... No, I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen it. Curtis Dixon. It was cool to see Yokozuna dominate everybody. And then he calls this Razor Ramon promo kind of creepy.
Sam Ho. Don't ever make me do that again. The highlight of the Rumble should be Giant Gonzalez giving Undertaker a chokeslam.
Steve Riddle. This is a very average show. We just got two big debuts in the Steiners and Luger, but both are just lukewarm. Michaels Jannetty was good, but could have been so much more. Bossman puts over Bigelow in an okay match. Brett Razor is very good and a hidden gem for both men. The Rumble's okay is Flair making his last pay-per-view appearance, getting tossed by Perfect. The debut of Giant Gonzalez, which leads to the worst two matches of Taker's career. Bob Backlund putting on a great performance, the Savage foolishly trying to pin Yoko at the end. Yoko is the right guy to win and helped elevate him. Overall, decent show that is way below Rumble 92, but not clearly the worst Rumble ever. Also, on a side note, to clear up the Survivor Series DVD question, the first 10 have been released on DVD in two 5-disc packs.
Okay. My favorite history of WWE member's name. I mean, this guy has an awesome, it's like an awesome world-class.
I think it sounds more like a rock star.
Yeah, Roger Lee Vest, Jr.
Yes.
What a performance by Bob Backlund. We were all watching, thinking Yoko was due for the everyone team up on one man and eliminate him treatment, so we were surprised he won it. We were all cheering for Mr. Backlund in that one. The 89 Rumble is still my favorite Rumble match-wise with 1992 close, but this one is up there for me as well. Okay, interesting.
And John Marotte. Macho should have won. Finish was weak. WrestleMania 9's week 2. Steiner's Beverly Brothers, decent tag match. So, as always, thank you very much to the Place to Be Nation and the history of WWE.com Nation as well. So,
yes.
With that, we're going to wrap up. We hope you enjoyed the 1993 Royal Rumble. We will be back later this week, most likely Wednesday night, with the headlines. We're going to talk Night of Champions. We're going to talk Raw. Any other news, of course, we'll be crowning the now weekly Asshole of the Week. I'm going to put the thread up for you guys to nominate some guys for that. Also, we're going to have a special guest. Our buddy Andy Flanagan is going to return. We're going to talk the Curb season. And also going to give you guys the details. You may have seen all the videos and pictures I posted on the Facebook page throughout Saturday night detailing the MWF 10 show we attended this past weekend.
Yes.
So we have some good stories that we're going to share with you. And then, of course, we'll be doing our Week 3 NFL recap and picks. So,
yes.
Please visit us on Facebook at the Place to Be Podcast Facebook page, historyofwwe.com, message board, Bigelow34, proboards.com, and of course on Twitter at Place the number 2B Podcast. You can follow us there as well. So, Scott, anything else before you wrap up?
Nope, we're done. Good show tonight.
All right, hope you guys enjoyed. We'll talk to you Wednesday night. Take care.
Peace.
See, that's how that shit down be, man. That's how my daddy raised me. That glitterin may not be gold, don't let nobody play me. If you are my homeboy, you never have to pay me. Go on and put your hands up, and times is how you stand up. L-U-P the man, cause the brand that the fans trust. So even if they ban us, they'll never slow my plans up.